Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review.
Hey guys, just a quick reminder, you are listening to the Elite Man Podcast. Throughout this episode, the word Giving Shy Guys Game Podcast may be referenced or referred to several times. These were just some of our earlier episodes, and I just wanted to remind you, you are still listening to the Elite Man Podcast. Okay guys, enjoy the show. On today's episode, episode number 15, entitled Winning the World's Toughest Mudder, we chat with two-time World's Toughest Mudder winner and one of the best obstacle course racers in the world, Junyoung Pak.
Junyoung, thanks so much for coming on our show today.
Sure, thank you for having me.
Absolutely, man, it's my pleasure. Can you jump into it and tell our listeners a little about your background and how you got started in doing these obstacle course races?
Sure. Well, I've always had an affinity for obstacle course racing. You know, it just wasn't called obstacle course racing at the time. I've always loved racing. I've always loved climbing stuff. I was a rock climber, not professional or anything like that. Very competitive, always. Whatever I did, I'd give it 100%. You know, just having a wide skill set and being proportionately strong, all those things lend itself really well to being a good obstacle course racer. And when the sport really introduced itself back in 2010, I was all over it. I saw the light and it was my calling, enough so that I really changed the direction of my, sort of the trajectory of my career. I left a salaried position at an engineering company, well, technology, and we're building some really cool stuff. It was a great job, but I just wasn't super happy doing it. And I thought, well, I can do it all. You know, I can take my skill set and bring it into all the things that I love and make a career out of it. And so I've been struggling with that the last couple of years, but I've been kind of competing at a high level and trying to figure out the best angle for turning this into a business.
So it sounds like you're kind of switching away from more of the technology background that you have, the business background, and kind of shifting your focus more into what you really love, like the obstacle course racing.
Well, I've shifted away from being the 9-to-5 office engineer and taking that same skill set and applying it to the obstacle racing world and running racing and fitness in general. So, I mean, for instance, obstacle design requires a lot of engineering and ingenuity and innovation. So I can consult for race companies and get them new obstacles, stuff that nobody's ever seen before, and bring it to them, design it, draw it up, draft it up, make prototypes of it, and even help them construct it. You know, that's a really cool way to still be an engineer and do it in a field that I really want to be in versus what just pays the bills.
Cool. It sounds like a dream job almost. Like you get to do exactly what you love, but then take those skill sets from what you learned and what you're really good at and just kind of apply it to that too. That's cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's analogous to, let's say, a surfer who just wasn't happy with an office job and they weren't happy with the way boards were being made. So this guy goes off and starts his own board company, you know, board shop, crafting exactly what he wants to his own specifications, what everybody else, what he knows the world would want, and goes out and does it.
Ooh, you really can't get any better than that.
Yeah.
Junyoung, can you tell us about some of the races that you've been in, some of the most enjoyable and yet at the same time crazy and absolutely insanely challenging courses that you've done?
There have been so many insane races that I've done. It just seems like they just keep getting more and more insane. Every time I say that this is the craziest thing I've ever done, the next race goes and tops it. I must have said that probably about a dozen times over the last 5 years, and I've no doubt that it's going to continue to be the case. Like back when I did my first Tough Mudder back in 2011, I think it was, at Mount Snow in Vermont, I did that thing twice, and I thought that was the craziest thing I'd ever done. So hard and so tough. And then in the grand scheme of things, that was probably one of the easiest races now, because then you had World's Toughest Mudder. That first year, it was, you know, for people who don't know, that's a 24-hour all-you-can-run and obstacle buffet. and the first year, it was operated, like, people didn't know how to actually do it, the race company. So it was put on in the middle of December in New Jersey on the coldest day of the year. And it got down to 22 degrees at night, and obstacles were freezing over. The water obstacles were starting to form like 1/8-inch layers of ice that you'd have to break through. And the wind was like 15-20 mile an hour, and it was just insane. Nobody was out on the course except for the 10 people who were left running it. That was pretty crazy. Then you go to Spartan Death Race, which is, it's gotten a crazy following, but and it's become a little more commercialized now, and people know what to expect. But back when I first started doing it, you really had no idea what to expect, like how long the race was going to go. And from year to year, year over year, like once, the first year that I did it, the guy who wanted it in like 45 hours. And then the following year, it was like 60 hours. And this is like 60 hours continuously doing stuff, being tasked. You're not taking naps and being tortured, basically, like in every way possible. Having to roll through a field six times, a 300-meter loop field six times, and having to stir rotting cow entrails in the middle and rolling through other people's vomit, like that kind of stuff. It's obviously not for everybody, but it's just the level, the talent and determination of the athletes that come into these events is just like second to none. It's amazing how tough some of these people are who show up to these events. Like another one that I did was this event called the Fuego y Agua Survival Run in the jungles of Nicaragua on this remote island of Ometepe. And basically the island is basically formed from volcanoes, too, like one of them is still active. And it's just the most remote place I've ever been in the world. It really is just like just getting out of your comfort zone. There's a real sense of danger. There's no safety line for you. And we're having to scale these really sketchy trees, do things that would not comply with OSHA standards, let's just say. And, you know, that all these events are like, you know, multi-day or full day, 24-hour type events, and they really test your limits, and you learn a lot about yourself, you know, where what you're made of in these events. So very cool. I'm super lucky to have had those experiences. Not everyone gets those opportunities.
Yeah, it sounds like you're actually pretty humble with some of your, you know, descriptions of like just how crazy these things are, which is like for our audience, anybody listening, they're probably hearing it like, oh yeah, it sounds pretty dangerous or whatever. But like realistically, like these things are insanely dangerous. And to even complete one of these is just like an unbelievable life accomplishment. And the fact that you regularly win, or at least are in the top, you know, couple finishers in these events is just incredible. Like, for instance, I did, like we mentioned earlier, before we went on, I did the Ultra Beast, which is a 26-mile obstacle course race up in Vermont. And they started a couple of years ago. And needless to say, I did 13 miles and I thought I was going to die. I was probably like the worst 13 miles of my life that I had to do. It's just like up and down these mountains up in Vermont, and the thin air, the steep peaks, you know, the obstacles that you have to do, the conditioning that it takes to do it. I mean, just like your legs are burning after just a couple miles, your throat's burning, you have no energy to do it. It's just insane, like the amount of physical pain and threshold that you have to put yourself through. to do these things, and it's really incredible. Let me just, for some of our listeners, I want to just rattle off a few of the accomplishments of some of these races that you've done, if you don't mind, Jun Young.
Sure.
So Jun Young has won, like I mentioned earlier, he's won two of the world's toughest mudders in a row, which is, like you mentioned, it's basically running the 13-mile course. Correct me if I'm wrong, too. It's running the 13-mile course as many times in a row in a 24-hour period. Is that right?
The distance changes, but it doesn't really matter on distance because you're just continuous trying to get as
basically
many miles.
You try to get as many miles in 24 hours. And would you get like 90 miles in a row or something? Is that what the winning time was for one of them?
Yep. That was back in 2012. Yeah.
So back in 2012, Jun Young ran 90 miles in a row through unbelievable obstacle course conditions of, I'm not really familiar with the Tough Mudder. I know they have the electrical thing, they have barbed wire, all that stuff. Any other obstacles that you can think of from Tough Mudder?
Yeah, there are a lot of, it's a very unique race because, or event, they call it. And World's Toughest Mudder is their only race, per se. But they test your mental and physical limits because there are things like rings that you might see at, you know, like American Gladiators, those hanging tough is what they call it, where you're swinging from gymnastics ring to gymnastics ring. They have those type of obstacles. They got rope climbs and your standard cargo nets and stuff like that. And then you've got, it spans from there to obstacles like the Arctic Enema, they call it, which is where you'll have to jump into a giant dumpster full of ice and be completely submerged. And, you know, that doesn't take much skill, but you have to be willing to do it over and over and over. And then you've got those electric obstacles, electrified obstacles, which are no joke. It's not like they're just making it for show. Like, people get knocked out if they get hit by one of those wires at full charge. And so again, that doesn't require any particular skill set except just the willingness to go through it over and over. So it spans a nice skill set and mental skill set, and it stays very true to its name, you know, Toughest Mudder, versus like a Spartan race, which is primarily a fitness contest, you know. So it has its merits. A lot of people, you know, probably naysay its credibility, but people are starting to catch on that this is a real category in and of itself, like respecting it.
Absolutely. Let me just finish off with a couple more. You won, you're a Guinness World Record holder for the fastest marathon carrying a 40-pound pack. Also the 2013 Reebok Spartan Race Ultra Beast Champion, which I believe I competed in the 2012, which was the year before. So you won the following year, which is, like I said, that was just unbelievable. And I did half of that, and you ended up winning the following year. So that just amazes me. That race was so hard. Multiple top 100 finisher at Boston Marathon. Second in the 2012 Spartan Death Race, which you mentioned earlier. And also, among other things, Obstacle Racing Media's top OCR achievement of 2012. Obviously, it's a laundry list of unbelievable accomplishments, and it really is incredible. Like you said, it's not just the physical endurance that it takes, but more of the mental and determination and the will that it takes to really overcome some of these things. Because like you said, it doesn't take much skill to be submerged into ice-cold water, but it does take unbelievable amounts of willpower to do it and to keep doing it and keep pushing yourself. Can you talk about that, you know, mindset?
Yeah, I mean, there's a nature versus nurture argument about whether, you know, toughness, mental toughness is where it comes from. And I think it has a little bit to do with both. You know, I've always naturally been very adventurous right out of the gates. You know, as a 5-year-old, I'd be traveling across town to visit my friends on my bike. That wouldn't fly these days. But, you know, I've always been pushing myself. Like, my parents have always discouraged me from pushing so hard, but that kind of made me want to be better in a way. Not out of defiance, but just because I knew that I had it in me to become tougher, to find my own limits. And it's been an interesting journey of discovery along the way. I really attribute a lot of my disposition to my upbringing, just having a lot of flexibility to do what I've wanted, even though it's been discouraged. You could take a look at my siblings, and they're sort of polar opposites of me. You know, we came from the same gene pool. That's where the nurture aspect of it might come into play, because, you know, they might have forged their own path, my siblings, and I didn't want to go down that path, so I made my own path. And it takes a certain person to go take that unbeaten path when, you know, you know that it's not going to be easy. And thankfully, I've succeeded and can tell them, you know, this wasn't necessarily the wrong call, even though they think that I'm nuts for leaving a full-time job. But yeah, I mean, it really depends on your perception and your natural predisposition. It's not for everybody. You know, there needs to be people who go to the 9-to-5 jobs, and there are people that want control and lives, routine and regularity. Now, I'm just not one of them.
Yeah, I would say that I'm definitely not one of those people either. But like you said, a lot of people have to have that routine and that regularity. They need like a strict schedule to kind of plan them their day out and their week out and their months and even years out. But it's good. It's good to do what you want. And if you're not inclined to be that way, it's good to kind of go against the norm and do what you want to do and what makes you happy.
Yeah. And to add to that, it's not polar. You're not one or the other. You don't have to be one or the other. There's a whole spectrum, and you can fall somewhere in between. You know, if you're not happy with your job, you should think about, really take a deep look into yourself and see, ask yourself if this is really what you want. And if it isn't, then be the change that you want to see. Go find something that you're really passionate about and do it. You know, don't let it always come down to dollars and cents.
Absolutely. Can you talk about, John Young, your preparation before a major race? Are you nervous at all on the day before or the day of, say?
I wouldn't say I get nervous anymore, and I wish I would, because that helps racing, especially in the shorter events. But I do get anxious now. I used to never get nervous or anxious, and now I kind of lose sleep sometimes, and that's a problem. So it's something that I'm working on, because, you know, I'm no longer, not by a long shot, invincible. There are guys beating me all the time, and so I'm switching gears, and I'm trying to do what I can to roll with the tide. But the nervous aspect of it is very much in your control. It's your mental mindset that you can choose to be the subject of fate, or you can determine your own fate. And that's where, you know, you can say that I'm in control of my life, and I'm in control of what I need to do in this race tomorrow. And I know what I need to do, and I'm not going to be nervous. That's something I still need work on as well. But once I nail that, you know, I'll be back to where I was when I had all the confidence in the world, and I'll know that when I step to the starting line, I'm prepared and I'm confident. And although I'd like to be a little nervous, you know, I won't be anxious.
Cool. So for a lot of people listening, I'm sure they want to get some good advice about, like, maybe some of your techniques during the race. But can you talk about, like, how you pace yourself? Obviously, if it's a marathon kind of race, like if it's like, or even something longer, like even 10, 15, 20 miles, you're not going to want to sprint. You're not going to want to go fast. What would you say it is for like a percentage of like how you pace yourself? Maybe like 60%, 70%? Is it something like that or a little different?
Well, it actually starts days and weeks and months before that in your training, because your training will tell you. If you train smart, methodically, intelligently, it's not a guesswork where you're going to finish or what you can do. Your fitness tests, you know, these indicators will tell you where you should be, like how hard you can push. You'll get a great understanding of your body. And it's not going to be about this number that you push yourself to. It's going to come very naturally. You'll know, all right, this is the level of effort that I think I can hang on to and maintain throughout the race. And that's also going to be a function of each individual. I know a bunch of guys that just love to go out hard and just hang on for dear life. I tend to go out a little more conservative, and because I'm disciplined enough and I know where my fitness stands, I generally go out slower and then just accelerate and accelerate and accelerate until I finish cross the line with little to nothing left. But that really comes from your training and being able to understand your body and your body's limitations. So it's hard to say. You know, generally, if you're starting out, I would say negative split, so to speak. On an obstacle course race, it's hard to say because it's not like a certain distance and a certain time that you have to be at that halfway mark. But trying to put harder effort into your second half than the first half, so you're not rendered useless by going out too hard.
So just say, for instance, if you are a little conservative at the start of a marathon race and you notice a lot of people getting ahead of you, maybe some of like your top competitors or you know are going to be there right along with you at the end of the race, does that make you pick it up a little bit, or do you not care like if they shoot ahead of you and you don't see them for a while?
That really depends on what kind of race you're trying to carry out. It's very different when you're trying to win a race versus trying to PR or set a fastest time. Because if you're trying to run the fastest that you can, chances are, at least on roads or something that's level and flat throughout the race, you want to meter out about the same amount of energy from start to finish. You're going to get fatigued towards the end, and it's going to seem like your effort's going up, but your pace is going down. That's the best way to run the fastest race. But if you're trying to win the race or trying to like beat somebody, sometimes you have to go out of your comfort zone to, you know, keep your competition in sight so they don't run away from you. There's a big psychological aspect to it. For a long race, it's not nearly as important that you hang on to someone. You can always make it up on the back end if you're strong mentally. Just focus mostly on settling into your pace and pushing yourself at the max limit for the distance that you're going to cover. A shorter race, you're going to have to kind of go a little bit more aggressive. But the same principle applies. You can still negative split on a short race. And it's a devastating blow when you come up on somebody in that last, you know, quarter or tenth of a race and you pass them with authority. It's hard to answer that.
Well, by the end of that race, like say coming down that last kind of stretch, are you basically like at a full-on sprint at that point?
Well, it depends on the distance, but I generally pride myself on nobody out kicking me at the end. So if there's somebody within striking distance, I generally track them down and I hunt. For a marathoner, you know, I do have that top gear. So it's a good tool to have. You know, like if you've got a good strong kick, you can run a really tactical race. You can let somebody take the lead and you either draft off them or just play on their mind just by sitting on them and breathing down their neck the whole time. And then I'll kick them at the end. Or if they want to go hard from the start, you can hang with them too that way and just cover every one of their moves. There are definitely many ways that you can win a race, and like having an extra gear that you can shift into is a major tool.
Cool. So not only do you have the marathon ability, but you're also a good sprinter as well?
Relatively speaking, I think so.
Cool. Yeah, so it's definitely a great advantage, I'd say, over a lot of other marathoners who don't necessarily have like those fast twitch, you know, muscle fibers in their legs that can make them go fast when needed in short distances. What's the longest race you've done and also the shortest race you've done?
Let's see, the longest race I've done in recent history would be the World's Toughest Mudders, where I'm running, you know, 95, close to 100 miles over 24 hours. I wouldn't mind trying, like, just straight up ultra marathon sometime, just, you know, 50K or 100K to start. That'd be like 30 to 60 miles. And then the short end of it, I just jumping into some indoor track races this winter, going down to as short as 800 meters, which is, you know, on an outdoor track, two laps around the track. So those are fun. I mean, I I've certainly lost a lot of my wheels, but just getting out there and going hard from start to finish is pretty exciting, especially when you got 10 guys right around you and you're jockeying for position.
Yeah, that's got to be pretty competitive, I'd say. John Young, how old are you, if you don't mind me asking you?
I'm 37.
37. So a lot of these races that you do obviously take a toll on your body. I'm kind of curious, like, do your knees ever hurt, or like say your back ever ache, and do you ever get any like real injuries that might follow doing a lot of these races? Because a lot of people just can't run a marathon, even 26 mile, like a Boston marathon where there's not obstacles in it. They can't do that because of, say, the toll it takes on your knee. So what do you do to stave off some of these injuries, or why do you think you've been blessed to be able to do some of these long distance races?
That's a large part of it is exactly that. I've been blessed with some good genetics and biomechanics, and part of it is just intelligence. I've had just about every injury under the sun, like common running injury, IT band syndrome, you know, tendonitis, Achilles tendonitis, like all kinds of soft tissue injuries all around the foot and ankle and shin and hip soreness and all that kind of stuff. But I've taken it upon myself to learn, because there's nothing that a doctor knows that you can't learn yourself either as well. So I've become my own doctor and my own coach and the athlete. And I think if you want to be successful, whatever you do, you shouldn't rely on other people to spoon feed information to you or tell you exactly what to do or just tell you that something's wrong but not why or how to fix it. Like if you go to a doctor, they'll tell you, all right, take this much rest or do this training regimen or recovery regimen to get better. But oftentimes they won't tell you why. And that's sort of where I've taken it to the next and taking it upon myself to understand and become an expert at this sort of stuff, because I have a curious mind, you know, and I think that's the key to success in this sport, is just being able to stay training, stay healthy. And in order to do that, you need to stave off injuries. And you know, a lot of these injuries, if you just think critically, you can get to the root cause of the injury and address it and come out of it at least as healthy as you went in. And that's exactly what I've done, is I've just dissected the anatomy of training and injury prevention and injury recovery. And so I've had a very, very long stretch of healthy training, which is, you know, not something that everyone has the luxury of. And so, you know, I'm starting to get into my golden years, sort of, so to speak. But I'm still able to train at a high level because, you know, there's really not that much different for me now than a 20, 21 or 25-year-old version of myself. It's just how much work do I want to put in? It's really what it comes down to.
All right, guys, I think it's the perfect time to take a quick break from the episode to remind you to subscribe to our show. By subscribing, you get every single episode completely free. That's right, get all of our best interviews with the best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and entrepreneurial worlds absolutely free. Don't miss out on any one of our captivating and exciting episodes. Subscribe now and get all of the Elite Man podcast anytime and anywhere. And yes, if you get a chance, leave us a glowing review about how much you love the show and how awesome we are. Okay, guys. Back to the episode now.
Before we touch on some of your diet and training, do you think anyone can run a marathon, or do you think it does have to do with like your genes, like you talked about earlier, and kind of what you've been blessed with?
I mean, the marathon is a very interesting distance because this caloric perspective, it exceeds what the body is capable of running without depleting oneself of their available energy stores. But with proper training, you can extend your tap into your body reserves, fat stores, so to speak, or you can supplement along the way by eating calories, and then it becomes sort of a mind over matter thing. people in terrible shape have been able to transform themselves and jump into this fitness, onto a path of fitness, and been able to finish a marathon. They don't have to win it. They don't have to finish even, you know, they could be last, but if they're finished, if they cross that finish line, they're still a marathon finisher. You know, and that's ultimately what a lot of these marathons and obstacle races are about. It's not just about doing them as fast as you can, but it's also about finishing them. And with enough training, with the right proper training and proper diet and keen ear to the ground on health, yes, I would say anyone is capable of finishing a marathon.
Cool. So can you talk about some, like, what your diet is now? I know you try to stay as healthy as you can and try to avoid injuries and everything like that. And obviously, to be one of the best obstacle racers in the world, it really has to take a strong ethic and an incredible diet. What does your diet look like from day to day? Like, what are some of the foods that you eat?
Well, my girlfriend actually cooks a lot for me, so, and she's a very healthy eater, and so I've started eating a lot more healthy. But that's not to say that I ate unhealthy or that I eat healthy all the time now. I think it's about sustainability, because a lot of people think vegan, 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 that's the way to go, or paleo, paleo, that you have to eat it that way. Atkins diet, or, you know, just people think that there's only one right approach. A lot of people think that, and the right approach is the one that you can reasonably sustain and meets your happiness criteria. Let's face it, we all love to eat, and what's a life with eating things that you absolutely hate, and every meal becomes a laborious chore? That's not, first of all, it's not sustainable, and second, it's
sucks.
Not. Yeah, it sucks. So I generally eat very healthy, but a well-rounded nutrition of, you know, carbs, proteins, and fats. I don't have any particularly specific diet. I don't feel that I need to until either training for something extreme. You know, if I was training for like a 100-mile race or a marathon, I'm going to look more closely at trying to tailor my diet to tap into my fat reserves, you know, like eating a hot, like kind of becoming more fat adapted. That's what they call it. And that's just that's something that most people don't necessarily need to do. So I wouldn't advise that you do it unless if you just prefer it that way. But most people run races that are well within their tank capacity. So they can eat kind of what they want, just a well-rounded diet. I mean, I'm going to let the cat out of the bag. There's no, if I were to take, assign a percentage, like a time percentage in performance improvement directly as a result of your day-to-day diet, I would say it's on the order of less than 1%.
Wow. That's
your diet does not affect your race performance nearly as much as your race day nutrition. Like if you take, you know, caffeine before a race, that has a potential for a big improvement. You know, if you take supplements that like increase your blood capacity, oxygen capacity, like this product called Beet Elite, which increases the nitric oxide levels in your blood, and that helps. I wish I was sponsored by them, but
what's that one, Speed Elite?
It's a really cool idea. I'm not sure. I haven't done enough scientific study on myself to verify whether it helps or not, but that sort of stuff really helps. And aside from that, I would say the one other major, major factor is post-race nutrition or post-hard workout nutrition. And that's where I would stress the most amount of focus on proper diet. Like when I'm in my high mileage block training sessions or hard effort type training block, I will make sure that I prepare enough protein and enough nutrition immediately after the workout to flood my body with the nutrients that it needs to repair itself so that it heals as fast as possible and you're ready to go again as quickly as possible. And you don't break your own body down to get those nutrients as you starve yourself. And, you know, immediately after a hard workout is when your circulatory system is most primed for delivering these nutrients. So, like, it's imperative that I take protein supplement. Oftentimes I'll mix that up before I go out for my run. And as soon as I come back, I'll slam it. And that works really well, in my opinion. And other things that I do is I do a lot of preventative maintenance. I've been taking glucosamine, various formulations of it, glucosamine chondroitin with MSM. And they have various formulations now, but the stuff, I believe in it. I mean, the jury's still sort of out about it, but as a mechanical engineer, I believe in keeping the body, keeping the machinery lubed. And that's exactly what the stuff is. It's a joint lubrication, and it has elements of building blocks of cartilage and connective tissue, which is what you're breaking down when you're exercising over long hours. So it just makes every bit of sense for me to put back into my body when I'm breaking down. And, you know, it's one of those benefits that you don't really get to appreciate if it's working well. You know, if you weren't taking it, then your body might get injured. Then you would know if it's making a difference. But it's one of those like ungratifying things to do, because you're taking it and you don't know if it's making much of a difference. But if it's doing its job, nothing happened, right?
Yeah.
And it's not cheap, so I think a lot of people have a hard time swallowing that pill. But I wholeheartedly believe in it, and I think that's one of the secrets to my success is I haven't been, as injury prone because I've taken these sort of measures.
Yeah, it's like an insurance policy, right? You're not gonna really know anything's wrong or that you need it until something goes wrong, and then if you don't have it, you're kind of screwed. But
yeah,
I'm kind of huge on supplements as well. Not really like the performance enhancing ones, but more of like the vitamin kind of mineral supplements, and also like some herbs and stuff, and probably a lot more than I actually should be, because like you said, a lot of it isn't proven yet, but I kind of do a lot of research beforehand and pick out things that I think have a lot of, kind of studies to back it up, or even anecdotal research to back it up, and stuff that I tried and test myself before I actually continually use it. But that's good. I do believe in, like the joint support supplements, like the ones you take, and also that protein post-workout is huge because it's the time your body needs that nutrition the most, and definitely supplying it with a good protein powder or even just a quick meal that you can digest easily is very important. Jeon-young, can you talk quickly about, you mentioned that fat-adapted nutritional kind of state. What does that entail exactly? Is that more of like loading up on fat heavy foods, like good fats anyways?
Yeah, well, certainly it would probably work with just about any types of fat, but certain types of fats are much healthier than others. Like coconut oils, olive oils is like it's an MCT, a medium chain triglyceride, and it's very heart healthy and relatively easily digestible. It doesn't have much residual stuff like cholesterol. And, by taking these fats before or even during your training, your body will start to learn to break that down. There's several mechanisms. You can also kind of starve your body while you're in exercise. You don't want to do this all the time, but do long training runs where you deplete your glycogen stores in your muscles. That's your immediate tank. And once you run out of that, which usually happens after about 2,000 calories worth of effort on a full tank, then your body converts over to fat and muscle stores for fuel. And those are not nearly as efficient source of energy. So that's when you hear about people hitting the wall, bonking from a calorie perspective. energy perspective. And that's when your like stomach's churning and it needs to find fuel from your body fat stores. And when you do these long training runs without calorie supplementation, your body starts to learn. It's like, oh, okay. All right. So I'm going to go really long today. And, I've been doing these long runs and I've been running out of energy. I need to find a way to supplement that. It starts to break down fats in higher proportions sooner than later. So like right out of the gates, as long as you're not going into this anaerobic state where it really relies on carbohydrate as a fuel source, as long as you keep your main intensity below that aerobic threshold, then your body will start, over these long endurance efforts, start to break down fats right out of the gate. And it'll start trickling into your bloodstream. And by the end of 2 hours, you still have your sugar stores, your glycogen stores. And now you've burned a considerable amount of fat. And when you consider how much fat is on your body, if you're able to tap into that, you can run very, very long distances without supplementation. Now a pound of fat is 454 grams times 9. That's probably about 4,000 calories just from 1 pound of fat, if you can tap into that. So
it would be pretty amazing if we could just literally just burn the fat stores on our body and use that, you know, primarily as the calories burned, right? That'd be ideal.
Yeah, and that's what people talk about when they mention staying within your fat burning zone. It's not like a real, it's not a high intensity effort. It's below lactate threshold, below your aerobic threshold, typically well below it. Of course, you know, you can correspond it to your heart rate. That's, you know, training with the heart rate is smart if you know how to use it. And that's when you're going to be burning the most amount of fat proportionately. But the trick is, it's important also to replenish those calories. Otherwise, it won't really matter whether you burn the fat or the sugar, the glycogen, because after your workout, if you don't supplement with enough calories, it'll just steal those calories from other parts of your body and restabilize your proportions. It'll just take calories from one place and just put it back into your fat stores.
What would you replenish that with? Just a load up on protein? Or?
Well, it depends on what you're trying to do. But like, if you're trying to do these ultra long endurance events, you know, this like a fat based diet may be the diet for you. But for the most part, like people who are active every day and they're not trying to go for 100 miles at a time, you're probably best off with a well-rounded diet, like a well-balanced diet, a little bit of everything. Because if you go all carbohydrates, you know, it's hard to synthesize amino acids, like building blocks for muscles, just from carbs. Now, if you just take all protein, you need to break that down into and synthesize sugars out of that, and that's not an efficient process. So it's, you know, kind of depends on what your goals are. If you're trying to lose fat, body fat, then a mostly protein diet, that's probably the way to go. And again, I think it's important that you do your own research, because instead of just listening to what one expert says is not the solution, because it's not a one size fits all. There's a wealth of information online, and there's no reason why you can't be an expert in it as well.
Yeah, especially in this day and age with like Google and everything. It's so easy. It's like everything's at our fingertips. So why not do your due diligence and actually find out, you know, what's really right for you? Switching gears, can you talk about some of the training techniques that you have, some of the workouts that you might do for some crazy obstacle marathon race that you're like really trying to compete for that's coming up, say?
Yeah, I take a more holistic approach to training, because for various reasons I've not had access to training facilities like a gym, realizing that I'm going to have to pony up and actually join a gym, because the level of competition has gotten such that I need special instruments. But But for the most part, you know, if you're at ground zero, there's a lot that you can be doing to get yourself to a 90% version of yourself very quickly and easily. And firstly, you need to know where you're weak, right? And that's what you target. If you're trying to, depends on what your objectives are. If you're just trying to have fun, if you're doing an obstacle race, for instance, and you want to do every obstacle, regardless of how long it takes you, then because that makes you happy, then you focus on those obstacles. If you want to try and compete at a high level and you want to win, then you kind of break down, do a little analysis and break down how much cost and reward with those ratios are for different aspects of your training. You know, for most people, their greatest gain is going to be in the running department because obstacle course racing is still a race, foot race. So that's probably where most people want to focus their efforts on time-wise. But when I'm training, you know, I'm still doing the same thing. I'm focusing most of my efforts on the cardiovascular effort. Now that I've really taken the turn and committed myself to doing these obstacle races, I'm incorporating high intensity efforts where I'm trying to surge in my get my blood pressure and my heart rate to surge and trying to recover from that. That's something that I have a lot of headroom for improvement. And then some very basic things that you can be doing is focus on your, like, you know, analyze each part of your body and think, where am I deficient? Where am I failing these obstacles, or where could I be failing? And what do I need to make them stronger? So 99 out of 100 times, most people are going to, their weakest link in their body is their grip strength. There's a lot of grip strength obstacles, and so you should be focusing a lot of time improving that. Dead hangs and pull-ups. You could adopt the Navy SEAL style of training, you know, pull-ups, push-ups, and sit-ups. That's their bread and butter. If you did that and that alone, you'd be pretty darn good.
John Young, how long are some of your workouts? So like if you are preparing for like a marathon kind of race, you wouldn't obviously run, or would you? I mean, I don't really know. Would you run a marathon in preparation for running a marathon?
I wouldn't advise it for most people, but it's for somebody more seasoned, there's no other way. Well, there are other ways, but I've run marathon training distances in each of my lead ups to every one of my marathons. And there's no replacement for understanding how your body feels in that last mile of a marathon. Just knowing, having the confidence that you can run a whole marathon without even taking any calories, that's a big boost to your confidence. And that lets you go a little bit harder and take some more chances versus like doing 20 and 22 mile training runs as your longest and just not being quite sure what's going to happen when you reach that point. And for most people, it doesn't end happily. It's not a bad goal to have, but as an amateur, I wouldn't advise doing that without some amount of experimentation. Maybe you have a contingency plan. After you've done a couple marathons, you want to take your training to the next level. You incorporate a 24, 25, 26, or maybe even more miles long training run and have an out. You know, so if something goes wrong along the way, you can bail on the rest of the run and not get yourself injured.
Yeah, that's a great point, though. What are your thoughts on CrossFit? Because it's recently come on pretty huge over the last few years, and I've tried it before. I mean, it was okay. I didn't fall in love with it like a lot of people, but curious to see what your thoughts on it are. You obviously said you don't go to a gym, which I actually think is really cool, and as shocking as it is, I can kind of understand that because, you know, a lot of your training can be outside. A lot of it's running and stuff like that. But what do you think on CrossFit and some of the exercises that they do?
I love the concept of CrossFit. I don't love the price tag.
Yeah, it is pricey.
It is so expensive, and it's hard to justify for pretty much anyone without a sizable salary to make that work. Yeah. But I think it's great because it's a fitness trend. It gets people involved in a sort of a group exercise, a regimented group exercise. And that's what a lot of people need. Going back to that concept of sustainability, if you go to the gym and you don't know what to do and you're just kind of all over the place, nobody's telling you what to do, and you're not seeing results or you're not having fun, it's just you working out by yourself, you're probably not going to go back. I mean, there's a good chance that you might not go back. Like, people make all these New Year's resolutions at the top of the year to get fit, and they join a gym and it lasts 1 month. And then they pay this membership fee for another 6 months and they don't even use it. I think maybe the cost is actually, as strange as it sounds, that might be part of its success, because when you pay $150, $200, $250 a month, it's like, Jesus, I better go. You know? So maybe that's part of its success, but the elements of fitness I really admire. I think I love the cool things that they do, the fixtures that they have. It is sort of bare bones structure, but I would subscribe to it if I didn't do it more than maybe once or twice. I'd say less than once a week, I'd say, and it didn't cost that much, but I can't justify it because I can get just as good a workout doing my own thing, and I'm disciplined enough to do so. But for the masses, I think, hey, if that's what gets you outside or get sweating, you know, it's not a good, bad thing.
Jung Young, how has these obstacle course races and competing and actually having so much success, how has that helped you in other aspects of your life, whether personal or professional? Like, have you carried like some of that success onto other areas?
Oh, without a doubt. It puts a lot of things in perspective when you finish an event like the Death Race or World's Toughest Mudder and you endure these horrible atrocities, and especially when they're self-imposed for the most part. You know, you're subscribing to this pain and suffering. It's not like anybody's putting a gun to your head. It gives you a certain edge over someone else who has to be told to do this, to do their daily task by a boss or a manager. And, you know, you lack that self-drivenness if you've never experienced it. You know, like starting my own business, this is, it's been a challenge, but without a doubt, these elements of mental strength that I've experienced and have kind of developed from my years of obstacle course racing and adventure racing have certainly helped me get through these sort of uncharted territories. Like, I'm comfortable, super comfortable with being uncomfortable, like taking huge risks. That's what it takes to really succeed in life sometimes. Like, if you're trying to forge a new path, you need to be able to take that step in the direction that nobody's ever taken before. That's how innovation is done. And it's important that you're able to get that from yourself, and sometimes it's just this untapped resource that is triggered by an event like the Death Race or World's Toughest Mudder or the Survival Run, you know?
Awesome, man. I love that answer. Like, obviously it gives you just like such an unbelievable confidence, and there's something that you can really carry over to a lot of other aspects. Like you said, you're not being forced to do these obstacles unwillingly or forced to endure such, you know, incredible tests to your willpower and character and even physical strength. But the fact that you push yourself through these things and do so well and overcome and succeed in these things just has to give you just such an unbelievable confidence that you can really use, like you said, your business life, your personal life, just probably in everyday interactions, having this confidence with you is incredible. So I love it. Is there any last thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners, Jung Young? It's been a great interview so far and really such a insightful and interesting chat. Is there any other last message you'd like to leave our listeners, or even a place that maybe they can go to check out some of your upcoming stuff?
I think the takeaway from what I'm trying to say here is, I'll just kind of reiterate what I said before, is whether it's in athletics or your personal or professional life, in addition to being the player or the athlete, you want to be your coach and your trainer and your doctor, physician, the person on the sideline that helps you get back in the game from an injury. You know, you want to be all of these things. You just don't rely so much on other people telling you what to do, like feeding you specific information, and have an opinion and take on life with purpose. That's what I would have to say. Yeah. And you know, I'm going to be officially launching a website very soon called fastfunctionalfitness.com. And I'll be offering coaching and consulting services for racing, and particularly the OCR, obstacle course racing industries. So if you check it out, you know, I might be able to help you out.
Great, man. Please check out fastfunctionalfitness.com, like Jung Young said. Jung Young, it's been a really fascinating interview, like I mentioned earlier, and I'm so thankful that you came on today and shared some of your great insights into the obstacle course racing, the challenges that you do, you know, your diet, meal planning, training. It's just really fascinating. It was an awesome sit down with you. So thanks so much for coming on our show. I know our listeners are really going to enjoy these great insights and advice, man.
Sure. Thanks for having me again.
All right, guys. I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing, you get every single episode completely free. That's right, get all of our best interviews with the best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and entrepreneurial worlds absolutely free. Don't miss out on any one of our captivating and exciting shows. Subscribe now and get the Elite Man Podcast anytime and anywhere. And yes, if you get a chance, leave us a glowing review about how much you love the show and how awesome we are. All right, guys, that's it. Until next time, take care.